on public animals.
Okay, thank you very much. Right, hands up here, anyone who knows what a public analyst is. Oh, okay, maybe about less than 5%, but normally I get zero. Okay, so I'm very pleased to be asked to come and speak to you here today. Obviously there's been people from industry and from laboratories talking about auditing, testing the food, checking the food supply chain. But of course there is, despite all the media, there is still a system in this country operated by government to enforce food safety, food composition, food standards legislation, although it's creaking a bit at the edges. So I'm going to explain what the public analyst's role is in it. I've got quite a few slides here about DNA analysis and authenticity. I'm going to skip over those bits because Barbara covered quite a bit of that material earlier on. And really just to talk a bit about what public analysts actually do and how they sort of fit into the food system and how the testing that's done for enforcement sits with the testing that industry, the food industry is doing or maybe is not doing or wasn't doing in the past but is doing now. Okay, so I work for a private company called Public Analyst Scientific Services. It's part of the Eurofins group, which you may have well have heard of. Eurofins is a relatively new company, started off about, back in the 1980s as a university startup from the University of Nantes in France. It's now a multinational company. It's got laboratories in about 50 different countries, thousands of staff all over the world, and mainly concentrating on food analysis, agriculture, pharmaceutical, environmental, and really the start of it was the authenticity of food and using very new modern techniques to actually establish that food, the provenance of food, as you mentioned earlier on, which of course is something that's very important now in consumers' minds. A public analyst is basically, public analysts have been around, but we have our 150th anniversary last year. They came into being in the 1860s and 1870s through various pieces of legislation. There's the Adulteration of Food Act, which came out in 1860, and then we had the Adulteration of Food and Drugs in 1870. And this basically said that every food authority in the country, which is a local authority or your local council, if you like, has to appoint a public analyst to test food samples to make sure that the food being sold in that local authority isn't going to kill people eating it. So public analysts used to be individuals who were scientists. They wouldn't necessarily have had any qualifications, but they may have done experiments in their front rooms in their house. Get a few test tubes, a microscope, a Bunsen burner, and you're well away. Of course, things have changed an awful lot now. We've got our own laboratories, and local authorities tend to have laboratories. Each local authority used to have a lab. They were quite cheap to have one in those days, so you didn't need much kit. But these days, an awful lot of local authorities have closed their labs. It's not something that they have to provide, and labs are very, very expensive to run nowadays. So I think somebody mentioned this morning that just in the last sort of 10 or 20 years, the number of labs in the country has dropped from 50 down to 9 in England now. Most of those are still local authority labs, but the company I work for is sort of the main private provider of public health services. So so at the moment we're in Gloucestershire. So Gloucestershire County Council will have to write to somebody with the qualification of Mastership of Chemical Analysis and say, we hereby appoint you under the Food Safety Act as a public analyst for Gloucestershire County Council. You have to have, it has to be the individual who is appointed, and by law they have to do that. They don't then have to send us any samples. There's no requirement for them to do that whatsoever. And some local authorities in the past few years, and this has been brought out by the recent horsemeat scandal, with the parliamentary investigation, that some local authorities have gotten appointed public analysts, but they haven't taken any food samples, and they haven't had any samples tested. It's not because they can't bother or they're too lazy. Basically, they don't have the resources to do it, or they've had severe cuts, which means that money that they would have had to do it in previous years is now being diverted into something that's considered more important in that local authority, like provision for adults and child social care, which everyone would agree is very important. So the qualification is also in law. So by law, if you want to work as a public analyst, you have to have this mastership in chemical analysis. And basically, what this is it's a postgraduate qualification, and it's a mixture of analytical chemistry and law, which I personally find extremely interesting, because although chemistry is an interesting subject, it's good to have something to actually apply it to. And the idea is that when you get this qualification, you will be able to test any type of food, any type of animal feed, fertilizer, drug, or water, and you will then have the legal background to be able to interpret the results and come to an opinion as to whether the sample actually complies with the law, and whether it's legal to sell it, or whether it's actually going to cause anyone any harm. So then we issue a Food Safety Act certificate to the local authority, and we take the sample, and then it's up to them to decide whether to prosecute the company involved, which happens fairly rarely these days, or go back to the company who is either manufacturing the food or is selling it, and work with them to advise them on how they can actually comply. So, and within local authorities, it's generally trading standards officers who actually go out and do this work. You heard earlier from environmental health side, because environmental health generally tend to deal with hygiene and food safety, so talking about microbiology, bacteria, food poisoning, that sort of thing. And there's a national laboratory network, what's called the Health Protection Agency, is now called Public Health England in England. Nationally coordinated, centrally coordinated group of labs which do all the micro testing for environmental health. Trading standards look at the authenticity side of things, the standards, the things actually related to the legal standard that's required. So, for instance, something like chocolate has got to have a minimum amount of cocoa solids in it, otherwise it's not allowed to be sold as chocolate. So those sort of things have been checked. And also chemical contamination, which could include and other types of contamination, so things like allergens and obviously foreign DNA, which we have with the horse meat thing. So that would generally fall under agreement to trading standards, and they would take the samples and submit them to their public analysts. So we carry out all the chemical testing rather than the microbiological testing. And there's a much, much wider range of chemical testing that you can do on a sample compared with the number of bacteria, say, that you might be looking for in a hygiene sample. So there are only actually 29 public analysts left in the whole of the UK. There used to be over 100. The number of samples being taken by local authorities has really, really dropped over the years. Fortunately, there isn't now the requirement for the same number of public analysts. A lot of public analysts that have retired haven't been replaced because not so many people are doing the qualification. So that they're not eligible to actually come into the profession. So if you do fancy doing the mastership in chemical analysis, you're guaranteed a job for life. So the company I work for has got 9 of the 29 public analysts. We've got 4 labs in the UK, so we're by far, in terms of numbers, the biggest provider. I just want to show you a picture of our nice gleaming new lab, which we moved into last year. This is a Eurofins food testing lab. Do work for retailers and food manufacturers, and we're a separate company, but we're within the same building, we use the same lab facilities, and we're doing work for enforcement. So it's accredited to ISO 17025. It's an official food and feed control laboratory, which is something that if for labs to be able to test enforcement samples, they have to be officially recognised by the Food Standards Agency, which is the competent authority in the UK. And then we don't just use the lab in Wolverhampton to test these samples that we get. We also have Eurofins, as I mentioned, has got labs all over the world. We don't tend to send samples off to China or New Zealand, as it's a bit too far away. But we have, as you can see, got all these labs in Europe. And for instance, during the horse meat issue, we've got a lab here near Munich, which probably did the majority of the DNA testing, not just for us, but for countries all around Europe as well. Because although horse is eaten in many European countries, a lot of work was done with companies in France and Holland who were importing horse meat from Eastern Europe, and somewhere along the way it was being turned into beef. So also, the lab that Eurofins started off in Nantes, and the work done there is looking at authenticity of things like wine, fruit juice, you know, has it got added water in it? Is the fruit juice being sold as pure, freshly squeezed fruit juice? Has it actually been reconstituted from that concentrated juice? So there's, as has been said previously, there's huge amounts of money to be made in adulterated food. And unfortunately, the fraudsters who do this adulteration also employ analytical chemists. And the ways they find adulterating food are becoming more and more sophisticated. When you hear about these sort of hackers hacking into government computer systems, the same goes with food fraud as well. They've got very sophisticated people working for them as well. So our job is to try to stay one step ahead all the time of the criminals to try to work out what they're going to do next. And obviously that doesn't always work. Okay, so just to clarify sort of about the law. The law has been changed recently, and we've got new food information labelling regulations coming out, which very clearly state now that the safety of food and the way that it's labelled and the composition of it are the responsibility of the manufacturer. So this, I think, has maybe got a bit lost. The Food Standards Agency have been blamed for a lot of the things that went wrong with the horse meat issue. But at the end of the day, it is Tesco, it is Findus, it is the other companies, it's their responsibility to get it right. And it's their responsibility to make sure that they're auditing with their suppliers and that they know exactly what their suppliers are doing. So as I say, the Food Standards Agency has overall authority in the UK for ensuring that the responsibility for ensuring that the food that we eat is safe. And they're also they were responsible until recently for the standard of foods that's now been devolved to DEFRA, and that caused a bit of confusion during the horse meat issue because so some people were saying it's a safety thing, but then there wasn't anything wrong with the horse, so it was considered to be a standards thing. So was it the Food Standards Agency's responsibility or was it DEFRA? And there've been various government reports which have been issued sort of criticising the lack of clarity. The Food Standards Agency doesn't actually really have that much power, and it doesn't really do any sampling itself, or it doesn't have any power to prosecute companies for most of the food standards things. So, as I say, it's all devolved, it's all done at local level. And the UK is pretty much the only country in Europe where food safety is actually done at a local level. Most other EU countries will have national state laboratories and nationally employed staff who will go out and check food businesses for compliance. So, you can have a situation where you've got some very small local authorities. So, for instance, take, for example, Berkshire County Council, years and years ago, was turned into 7 unitary authorities, all quite small. And because of their small size, they didn't really have the resources to effectively monitor their local food businesses. As Berkshire County Council, they had the resources, but as 7 different unitary authorities, they just couldn't do it. So there has been a huge problem. There's something like 280 local authorities in England and Wales, and each one of those is responsible for enforcing food safety in their local area. So it's quite difficult to have a sort of joined up approach, and certainly a lot of local authorities are now having to work together and share resources to try to do a more effective job. So say training standards, environmental health, they go to retail outlets, they go to food manufacturing premises, catering premises, and as part of their audit and inspection process they will take samples which they will then submit to public analysts. We will test them in our labs and then write a certificate basically giving an opinion as to whether we think the sample complies, and then that goes back to the local authority and they make a decision on what to do with those results. So we can be called upon, say, to perform any kind of test. We heard about the Sudan dyes incident. These things just come upon us. Something appears in the press or some sort of release. And it's the same with the horse meat thing as well. One day something is in the paper, the next day we have to be able to test for it. So there's an enormous pressure to quickly develop methods. And I know somebody commented earlier that there's often a huge rush to get a method ready and validated and in use, and when ideally you should be doing a lot of long-term research maybe into these methods to make sure that they're absolutely robust and fit for purpose. But of course the labs are accredited, so we would never use a test that wasn't actually able to do what we said it was going to do. But so as Barbara mentioned earlier, there are all sorts, especially with DNA analysis, there are all sorts of variables and ponderables which need to be taken into account. So, you know, in years gone by, we used to test tomato ketchup to see how much tomato was in it, milk to see how much fat was in it, salad cream to see how much egg and mayonnaise, that sort of thing. We don't really do that sort of thing anymore. We're now really looking at adulteration and contamination because they're the major things. And DNA analysis has been an absolute godsend for testing for authenticity because pretty much all the food is from agricultural origin. It's from a vegetable or an animal which has got a distinct genetic profile and a species specific. So if you know what species you're looking for, then you can usually use DNA analysis to test it. So when I talk about authenticity, so you hear a lot of these words being used, and some people have different ideas about what it actually means. But really, as far as we're concerned, it's the genuineness of what the product is actually purporting to be. And that might be the species that it's purporting to be, or it might be the place that it actually comes from. And these are things that in the past it just wasn't possible to test for, and the only way that you could work out these things was to look at paperwork, look at invoices, try and work out where it would come from. So I'm not going to dwell on this too much because Barbara talked about it a lot earlier on. We've got the lab on a chip, which some people may have heard of, which is now sort of an obsolete technique, but this is the first widely used DNA analysis for things like fish species and meat species, which was just a qualitative, it was either a presence or absence test. Real-time PCR is pretty much the industry standard now. And this can be semi-quantitative, depending on what you're actually looking at. DNA sequencing is basically, you can get something, stick it into a DNA sequencer, it will elucidate the structure of the DNA in the sample, and using an international database will basically tell you what it is. Obviously it doesn't work very well with things that contain lots of different DNA species, but if you've got a piece of meat and you've tested it for pork, sheep, poultry, beef, all the usual things, and it's negative for everything, then you need to use sequencing sometimes to work out what it actually is, and it could be something pretty unusual and exotic. So I'm not going to go through this, so I think it's the day for beginning of the world of science. I just want to stress though that you do need good facilities and you need people who know what they're doing. There's been talk about techniques that can be used on site, and ELISA and lateral flow strip kits. They do have their uses, they are good for screening, but they do have limitations. There are certain conditions, such as temperature, under which they have to be used. There are always, the manufacturers who supply them, there are always limitations with them, and the operators need to know what they are. And there's nothing, I mean, I would say this obviously, and Barbara would as well, but you can't quite beat having a sample tested in an accredited laboratory to prove for accuracy. So obviously, you all know now that you can use DNA from meat species, but just to mention some of the other things that have also been used. Fish speciation, there's a huge problem now with fish adulteration. You may have heard various reports coming from the United States that red snapper frequently you buy it up in restaurants, you don't get red snapper at all. In this country, it tends to be cod and haddock, those sort of North Sea fish, which are almost becoming endangered and therefore very expensive, being substituted with very cheap, often freshwater white fish, farmed fish from Southeast Asia. Absolutely nothing wrong with them, but they're not cod or haddock, and they're a fraction of the price, so substitution can be very profitable. Durum wheat pasta, unfortunately an awful lot of the prime ingredients that come from Italy can tend to be adulterated. Things like buffalo mozzarella have been a problem in the past, the problems with olive oil, and various different types of cheese as well. Because there's a premium price on a lot of these products. So durum wheat pasta, basically, instead of durum wheat, common wheat is used, which the quality of the pasta is much worse compared to the genuine stuff. Basmati rice, we've heard about, being substituted with long grain rice. Thai jasmine rice, I'm going to talk a little bit more about it in a minute. Fruit juice adulteration with other fruits. This is supposed to be at the beginning and the end of the orange growing season, where the oranges may not be of particularly good quality. So to try to eke out the amount of juice that can be got out, other fruits like mandarins can be used. This isn't so much a problem now, because it tends to be that when we develop methods to actually detect these frauds, the frauds just have to stop doing it, and then they have to find something else instead. So often you spend a lot of time developing a method, and then it becomes obsolete fairly soon afterwards. But it does actually stop the frauds from occurring. And genetically modified organisms, which this is an authenticity issue insofar as some foods do make claims that they are GMO-free, or that they're identity protected and that they are guaranteed not to contain GMO, which is a very difficult statement to make on something, say, that contains soya. Particularly things like animal feedstock, where there's so much with that. So this is just an example here of the fish adulteration. On the left, you've got a cod. I mean, the whole cod is about this size. You never actually see a piece of cod. You normally see a white fillet about that size, and often you don't even see that because it's in batter and it's been deep fried. So most people can tell the difference between one piece of white fish and another. And some people might say, oh, so what, it's white fish, doesn't matter, it tastes nice. But it's the economic fraud. It's the person who's selling that is still charging you £5 for that first fish that they're buying at the fraction of the price that they would if it was genuine. So I'm not going to go into detail about the methodology of how this is done, but just to show you, this is the basically the different bands of DNA are separated out, and you get a peak for each piece of DNA, which is more easy to understand if you look at this. So basically we look at different bits of the DNA on three, basically cut the DNA of the fish in three different places, and you can see then for instance, the Atlantic cod, Pacific cod, and Alaskan pollock. If you just look at this bit of DNA here, Pacific cod and Alaskan pollock is the same. So just looking at this bit of DNA is not enough to differentiate between the two. Whereas if you look here, then there is actually a difference. So you look at three separate parts of the DNA, and you can differentiate between pretty much all of the main species of fish. And again, there is a database, Camden, what's now Camden DRI, set up a fish database a few years ago. They did all the work for the Food Standards Agency on fish species, and now it's pretty easy to actually identify any fish. Thai fragrant rice, this is a particular type of rice which, as its name suggests, has a very distinct fragrance. That fragrance is actually the chemical is 2-acetyl-1-pyrrolidone, which occurs naturally in the rice. But of course, you can actually make that chemical in a lab as well. So you can just get normal long grain rice and spray it with this chemical, and then to all intents and purposes, it looks and smells like Thai fragrant rice. So it's difficult to analyse that by testing for this chemical. But what you can do is there's an actual gene in the rice which codes the fragrance being produced. So you can basically do a DNA sequencing test on the Thai fragrant rice, and then this is a Thai fragrant rice here, and this is a non-Thai fragrant rice, and you can see they've got a different DNA profile. And then this is just an example here, where we've got this in here is a long grain rice, which is being sold as a Thai fragrant rice, and this is a genuine sample here. So it's pretty clear, there's a very clear difference between one and the other. Basmati rice, Jamie, did you mention earlier, there's a shortage of because of weather problems of rice. The UK is, I think, imports something like 80% of all the basmati rice that comes into the EU because of the large Asian population in the country and all of our love for curry. genetically modified organisms. This is a huge area of work, and I was over in our lab in Freiburg in Germany last week. We've got a lab that's just dedicated to testing GMOs, and this is a huge area. There are GMO crops that are authorised to be sold in food and feed in Europe. There's no authorisation to grow those crops, but they can be imported in from other countries. But if the GMO is not authorised and it's being sold, then that's not permitted. So an awful lot of testing goes on to check for these non-permitted GMOs. And it's not necessarily that there's a problem with them, but they haven't had any kind of safety assessment done on them. And they don't have an authorisation, so they're not allowed to be in food. There is a cut-off limit of 0.9% for adventitious contamination with authorised GMOs. So if your product contains more than 0.9%, it's got to be labelled as containing genetically modified soy, for example. And there are all sorts of new GMOs on the way. I mean, soya, maize, rapeseed are sort of the main ones around at the moment, but there are all sorts of soft fruits, things like salmon and I think papaya was mentioned earlier on from Thailand and the Philippines, and that has found its way into Europe. It's not authorised at the moment, and it generally, you might think, well, you know, who eats papaya, but it turns up in a lot of processed foods in a dried form, so things like cereal bars and all these sort of mixed fruit juices that often use like papaya. Okay, and then meat species, as I say, we've heard already, there's the protein-based ELISA technique where you have to basically look for one species at a time. The limit of detection is not as sensitive as DNA analysis, and it's a presence or absence test. You don't get any information about how much is actually there. The DNA base is very, very sensitive, almost too sensitive. The Food Standards Agency set a limit of 1% for horse DNA, but it is actually possible to get down to much, much lower than that. But the information about whether that actually equates to horse meat or not is another matter. Bush meat, just wanted to mention, this is a problem in certain parts of London and some of the other big cities in the country where there is a big African population, for example. Basically, illegally traded species, either endangered species, are on endangered lists, or species where there's a food hygiene issue. So you probably can't actually see these very well. This is a whole pangolin, which is some kind of a sort of reptilian rodent style thing. You can see the tail there. Smoked cane rat. These are all examples of samples that have actually been seized by trading standards or environmental health officers. They're usually sort of under the counter in shops, and people know where they can go to buy these products. And then that's just an example of the different DNA fragments and how you can actually tell these apart. And this is a Food Standards Agency project, which we did a few years ago, and they managed to get us reference materials of all these different bushmeats. I don't know how they did it. So we've heard about recent food scares. Obviously, there's the public health, public safety, but there's also an enormous cost for industry as well. Product recalls cost an absolute fortune. So everybody wants to avoid food scares. But possibly it pops in laboratories because they get a lot of money out of the So just mentioning the horse meat incident, 21 products tested in Ireland. There was a real difficulty with the results produced by the lab in Ireland because they reported the amount of horse meat to one decimal place. I think it was 29.1% in the Tesco burger. That may be a number that they achieve, but it's not possible. The uncertainty around that result is so huge that it should never have been reported in that way. And that's led to all sorts of problems for labs. When people, we say, well, the result is between 60 and 100% horse, and they say, well, how come the lab in Ireland can get it accurate to 0.1%? But it can't be done, basically. So some public analyst labs were using ELISA or lab on a chip, which is just qualitative to test for horse meat. The lab that I worked with was using the Eurofins lab in Germany, so we were able to use the very extensive method and the sequencing. And this did lead to a few problems with the Food Standards Agency. They commissioned a lot of testing, and it was difficult for them to compare all the results because all of the public health labs operate completely independently of each other. In fact, they're actually all in competition with each other. So it's difficult to get them all to work together and use the same methods. So really, I mean, obviously the whole topic of today is about food auditing, but I think maybe some of the retailers have possibly placed too much emphasis on looking at a paper trail, and that although that is the most effective way of doing things, there is a place for some testing. Testing is obviously expensive, and if retailers start testing absolutely everything for everything, it's going to really make the price of food go up, which I don't think consumers want. But I certainly think that it's now being recognised that there is a place for some testing as a sort of a belt and braces approach in conjunction with auditing. And it's also been highlighted as well that because of government cuts, there is a lack of resource now in local authorities to actually go out and inspect food premises, take samples and submit them to the labs. And so that because of that, the number of labs that are available to do the testing is dropping as well. So there is a real concern at the moment that in the future, if this kind of thing happens again, the country won't have the resources to cope with it. So no one's really got a horse joke in today apart from the horse's head of the burger, so I'll have to put one in at the end. And then just basically, as far as public analysts are concerned, since the Horsegate incident happened, Food Standards Agency and DEFRA are really keen to be seen to be working with enforcement, with local authorities and with public analysts to try to see how we can prevent this kind of thing from happening again in the future, or how we can actually have a bit more knowledge of things coming along. Everyone is now saying, what's next? What's going to be the next big food scare? And of course, nobody really knows. And it's FSA are very keen to try to get industry to sort of share more information with them about the testing that they do. But of course, there's a difficulty with that because of commercial confidentiality and lack of trust between the food industry and government. And that's it. Thank you very much.